upbeat kind of a reception. She was still
numb. There's no numbness. There's a lot of excitement.
Now, you said two children.
Okay.
The second one was not the way I was learning, but I think it's a very good bite for the chuck. Now, let me just tell you the way I was learning. When I thought about it. And I said to you before that the general nature of people is not to like talk this way. People don't like to, especially when they suffer misfortune, maybe amongst their close friends, they pour out, you know, you have someone that you pour out your feelings to, but you know what, the public, you like to keep a certain image, you don't want to pour out. So she went contrary to that. Now, I was thinking about it, this reflects the perfection. See, she realized that a great, great tragedy had fallen. She understood that. As a result, and she knew that it was a result of the fact that they had left Eretz Yisrael. And it was also tied in with the chet. I guess she realized afterwards that it was because of that, the chet, that they didn't want others, they wouldn't support others in the time of need and so forth. So she was extremely chastened by it. And she was in a state of, of tshuva. Now, most people, when they have bad experiences, or great than that, you know, like bad things happen to them, and they feel bad, they feel guilty, if they put them in a certain state, they may want to do tshuva. But there's always another part of them that wants to deny it. Okay? And when a person, what's very crucial is how other people look at them. That's why people are very much attached to how their image in society. And that's why they want to keep it hidden. As long as people look up to me, people are envious of me, people think I'm a success, and reinforces their ego. They feel really good. You see? If a person has been, experiencing misfortunes or whatever, he's beginning to think over his life that maybe he was wrong, maybe it's very difficult. Then suddenly he's welcomed back and people still look at him as a hero and everything, so then he's going to deny, and nothing happened, I'm still the same. You see? He'll revert right back to where he was. The social situation, you see? Because now when she's in Moab, she's away from everybody, she has no support, so then the harsh reality will descend upon her. And now that she comes back, she didn't know what kind of reception she would get. But apparently it was okay, I mean, she was still Nami, so she could have very easily gone right back into her old situation. So I think this shows her perfection. That was the second thing, that's the one, the second thing. That it shows her perfection. That she recognized, you see, that she did not allow the social reality, the fact of what people think, and that social support to have any effect. This brings many, many people down. Because a lot of times you find people that, for many years, they were prominent individuals, got a lot of cover, and then it turns out that they were involved in corruption behind the scenes. And as long as they were able to maintain that public facade, they didn't feel a shred of guilt. Now, one step, publicly, the public is everything. The public humiliation, then you can see they feel sorry, and they're broken, they have guilt, and this. But they've been doing the same thing for the last 25 years. Because as long as every time they come out, the public looks up to them, they bask in that, you see. So she could have fallen, she could have gone right back into that, that, oh, it's not so terrible, I'm still mommy, I'm still well-liked, I'm still popular. Now, that's what she wants, to negate that. And what the Rambam mentions, by the way, the Rambam does say that the ultimate form of tshuva, we don't do it today, we don't do it, but it's to confess publicly in the social situation. He confessed publicly. The Rambam talks about it in tshuva, to confess publicly, because as long as a person has his public image to go back to, that prevents him from doing tshuva. He's a good person in the public eye, but if you confess publicly, then that's the ultimate level of reality. So I think, let me just finish the point. I think that I hadn't thought of Laurie's first answer, which I happen to think is very, very good. I'm going to add, I think they both coincide. I think it was Tzedek HaDin. That's what we call Tzedek HaDin. That is to say, that when Diana Emes, that when a person has misfortune, they have to declare the righteousness, because then a person normally gets angry at God, when they suffer misfortunes. So there's a bracha. Dayan HaEmes, the true judge. And in other words, the person should realize that whatever sufferings they may have had is only because of their own shortcomings, that God rules the world with justice, and even if it's a situation which doesn't go your way, goes counter to your desires, it doesn't mean that there's any flaw in the system, any flaw in God. So that's what she declared. Don't call me. That's not me. I'm not that same person. I've been brought down. I've suffered terribly, and because of chet, because of my sin, God has done this to me. And she's not complaining. You see, that's what I'm saying. She wasn't complaining about God. If she's complaining about God, then this would be a low level. She's not complaining about God. It's acceptance. But accepting it in that situation where it would have been very easy to deny it. That was for her own perfection. But secondarily, I hadn't thought of what Lori said, you see. And I think that she's making an excellent point. And the two go hand in hand. And that is that there was a benefit for the public as well. You see, because there is, if you put yourself in that context, there is that emotion, and especially Jews, I think, are subject to it, perhaps a little bit more than others, that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. You know, there is that desire, because we always feel that we're restricted, you know, by all of the laws, and we're held back, and so on and so forth, and we can't really live like chutzlars. There's that allure of chutzlars, to be out, you know, that materialistic, oh, she left Israel, she was in, you know, she went to France, she went to Paris, it's glamorous, you know, like there's a certain allure. People have that desire. So therefore, I think it also serves, as Laurie said, I think it's a very good point, that she didn't want them to think that to be envy. There's an envy. There's always that envy that, oh, she left the land, she experienced chutzlars, and now she's coming back. She didn't want them to have any fantasies, any illusions. That's all imagination. The reality, this is the best place to be. I when I was here, that's when I had a full life. And when I left, I lost everything. So it was for their benefit as well. I think that primarily her motivation was, it was essential for her when they, see, when they presented it to her, they said, there was a whole tumult, the whole city was all excited. So primarily, she couldn't allow that to affect her. That would have destroyed her tshuva if she was affected by that. But of course, secondarily, it serves the purpose. It's chesed for the people as well. So it's double. It's doubly determined. Yeah, there are those who interpret as those nami, like she looked differently. She had suffered. She was older, and so on and so forth. You can read it that way. That's implication. But it says vateyom kol ha'ir, the whole city, right?
Right.
Okay. And when she says to them, but see, if Hazos Nami is really saying, oh my God, you look horrible, this is Nami. So then her reaction, don't call me Nami, doesn't really fit in that smoothly, because they really weren't calling her Nami. You see? You follow what I'm saying? In other words, they weren't, she doesn't mean that from now on I'm changing my name. I think that that's what, you know, the plain meaning, the plain sense is that, you know, it's a certain excitement. But Tehom, there was excitement. What was the excitement about? The excitement is that Nami's return.
But wouldn't there be, like...
Yeah, you would think so. We don't know the details. In other words, you can imagine that you'd get a negative reaction. It's not clear. You see, let's put it this way. You think you'd get a negative reaction. Here was a time of famine, and they were wealthy, and they left, and as you come back, people are going to be throwing stones. It doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, it seems to be a positive reaction. They're all excited. The whole city was excited. But I would say like this, that we don't know. We're not provided with the information here. You see, the only reason we know why he left and all the factors is because Chazal. It doesn't mean that the people at the time didn't read Megillah Esrus, and they didn't read the Chazal. They didn't have the Gemara, you see? So nobody knows. When Eli Melech left, we don't know what he told the people. But I'm sure he didn't make an announcement, I can't stick around, there's too many people bothering me anymore, I'm leaving. You see, they had no way of knowing this. So they didn't take it amiss. You see, it's not like they just,
you know, in the middle of a crisis, they could say, we're getting out of here. They, obviously, when people do these things, the other people, either they didn't know why, or they must have thought they had some justification. It's not as we see it, you see. As we see it, of course, the people will be upset with them. How'd you abandon us? But that's not the way they saw it. So they may have had some way of explaining it or justifying it, whatever the case may be. All we know is that when she came back, they didn't express hostility to her. She wasn't mistreated. So, therefore, I think, you know, I think my point is justified, that she was being welcomed back. Now, Hazos Nami, you could take it different ways, but still Nami. And she would not give in to that emotion. I believe that by making this declaration, she was, you know, preventing that. Continuing. Perek Beis. What happens next? So now we're introduced, Nami had a relative of her husband. It's her husband's brother. It's her husband's nephew. Ishki Bar Chayal. A man of valor. We don't know exactly in what sense yet, but we're going to find out. From the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. Okay? So the next phase deals with the encounter. It's phase two, is the encounter between Boaz and Rus. Alright, now what happened? Listen very carefully now to all the nuances. Rus the Moabiah says to Nami, to our mother-in-law, let me please go to the field and I will glean among the grain, the stalks. In the field of someone in whose eyes I will find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So basically, what is she saying? Obviously, you see from this that they were really impoverished. That they had nothing. And they needed food. Now, there's a halacha. You know what the halacha is. Leket, in Eretz Yisrael, when you have a field, there are certain portions of the produce that are designated for the onion. It belongs to the onion. It's not even for ducks. It's leket. Leket is what we're talking about over here. Leket is basically in the process of it was reaping. That's what we just learned. They were reaping the harvest. In the process of reaping, the person drops. And it's important to know this fact. Two stalks is leket. Three is not. He drops two, so then that's considered leket. That he can't take. That belongs to the onion. Okay. So that's basically, peah means the corner of the field had to be set aside. Shikha would be bundles that you forgot in collecting, so once you forgot it, it's left for the onion. We're talking here about leket. Okay? So, therefore, you can envision the situation that when they were in the process of reaping, so the poor people would follow the reapers. And anything which they had dropped in the process, that would be leket, if it was two. And yeah, but three you couldn't take. Okay. And that belonged, that wasn't really charity, that belonged to the Ani. Now, what Rus said, Rus knew the halacha, and she said she to her mother-in-law that she would go and then do it. Now, what do you see from this pasuk, though? What do you see from this pasuk? A whole new dimension of Rus is going to be brought out, in my opinion, in the ensuing circle. Just from the story of the Tanakh goes to a great length to describe the manner in which he went about getting leket, which seems to be a trivial thing, and you see that this is the basis for the encounter with, and the relationship with Boaz. Now what do you see just from this pasuk? She asks permission of her mother-in-law. What does she need her permission for? You don't need her permission to do it. She's entitled to it. She's poor. She's a permission. She could go out on her own. That's the first thing. You see? That's the first thing you notice. The second thing is, Achar Asher Emsa Chain Bieno. What does that mean? In the field of someone in whom I find favor. Why? There's no law that says you have to find favor in that person's eyes. Anybody, you go to any field, is you get online or whatever it is, you go amongst the reapers and you pick up leka. So what do you see something in this. Let's go on, let's bear that in mind. Let's bear that in mind. Two things strike me. That Nod is an expression of beseeching. She beseeches her mother-in-law to please give her permission when she doesn't need her permission in the first place. And secondly, she says, I'm only going to go to a field the owner of whom finds favor, I find favor in his eyes. Okay? And she says, go, my daughter. So she went. I mean, so we're going to have to ask ourselves the question, why is the Torah making such a big deal out of the fact that she goes gleaning? You know, what's the big deal? Now, she went, and she gleaned in the field after the reapers, and it occurred, you know, Chazal indicate that this was like the Ashkacha, because she had no intention of going to the field of Boaz. She just was going around looking for a field. And she happened upon the field of Boaz, who happened to be from the family of Elimelech, but it was prepared to be from the Ashkacha. It was designed that she would encounter that field, just that field. And behold, Boaz had just come from Beis Lechem. I Chazal say that his wife had just died. He was obviously, he was an older man, by the way, as you know. He was 80 years old. I think she was about 40. And he said to the reapers, may God be with you. And they said to him, may God bless you. Okay, we'll leave that aside for the time being. But now Boaz says to his youth, to his assistant, who the foreman, who was watching the reapers, who is that young girl? So he takes notice of the young girl. Now, of course, Chazal asked himself the question. Anyway, he was a big tzaddik. Was it his custom to glare at the young girls in the field? And is that not appropriate? And he took notice of her. It appears that he was looking at the girls. Chazal asked the question. We'll take that up the Gemara in a second. And the youth, who was watching over the reapers, said, she is a young Moabite who has returned with Nami from the field of Moab. Apparently Boaz knew about this, but he didn't know who she was, but he did know about Nami. And she said, may I please, you see, this is, she had asked, may I please glean and gather the sheaves after the reapers. And she came and she stood from the early morning until now, except the fact that she rested in the hut a bit. Alright? Then, let's just pause for a moment, because then Boaz speaks to Ruth. Let's just pause for a moment and analyze the Gemara. The Gemara in Shabbos asks the question. In Shabbos, the Kufyud Gimel Amudayis. On the verse that the Boaz asked his youth, who is this girl? So the Gemara says, Chidarko shall Boaz lishol benara? Was it the custom of Boaz to ask about the young girls? Am Rabbi Elazar, but Rabbi Elazar said, Dvar Chachma ra'aba. He saw her wisdom. A matter of wisdom. Shnei shibalin likta, shlosha shibalin eina likta. She would collect two sheaves, and three she wouldn't. Two stalks she would collect, three she wouldn't. That's the din of leka. So that's what it's so special about that. Masnisa tana, we also learned in a Mishnah, dvar tznias rabba. He saw her tznias, her modesty. Omdos, ma'umad, no flos miyusha. If the storks were standing, then she would gather them while she was standing. If they had fallen down, they were lying down, then she would sit down and pick them up. Means that she would not bend over, because that would be immodest. For a woman to bend over, it would be immodest. So, those are the two, that's what he saw. So first of all, I'd like to ask a few questions over here. He saw something which rendered him very, very unique. The Torah, in describing the behavior of Rus over here, is alluding to a certain uniqueness that she possessed. And on the surface, it doesn't seem to be. What we know is that she was impoverished and she went to glean. And so what's the big deal? And nevertheless, Boaz did notice certain qualities. So let's see if we can understand what were those qualities that he noticed. Why is that so significant? That that she took two and not three. I mean, I assume everybody would be that way. I mean, unless she's a thief. Interestingly enough, the parak begins by telling us that they had this relative, and he was a wealthy man, obviously, he had fields, but they didn't go to him for money. She didn't go to him for money or support. She went for gleaning, and she didn't specifically, she just happened to come upon his field, you know, by chance, so to speak. Or hashgacha, I mean, but that wasn't her intention. Also, I'd like, so the Gemara asked the question, was it his nature to ask after the girls? And her answer is, well, he noticed the Bar Kochma. Yeah, but why did he notice that? I mean, it still doesn't answer the question. I thought the point was that he wasn't paying attention to the girls. I mean, even in accordance with the answer that he noticed the Kochma, that's what he noticed. He did. Fine. But how did he notice that if he wasn't in the habit of looking at the girls? He must have been in the habit of looking at the girls. How does it really answer the question? You know? But all right. You see, you can tell the character of a person in different situations. Different situations bring out the character of a person. Of course, you can tell the character of a person when they're wealthy. You know, we see about Eli Melech, how he behaved in a situation when he was wealthy. Certainly success and wealth and power indicate are tremendous challenges. They bring out very powerful emotions, and it's a test of a person's perfection. Yeah, but there's another situation when a person is in a state of poverty, that's also a test. And very often it has a negative effect upon a person. The state, no situation, you shouldn't be envious of any, you know, no situation is going to automatically guarantee you, you know, perfection or... You see that, first of all, even though she was in a state of need and she had every right to go and collect, but she has to love him first. Okay? And most people, when they have this, they're in a state of need, so then they act differently. They now feel that they're entitled. The ordinary restraints are out the window. But you see, she was sensitive. She was sensitive. This is her mother-in-law. This is Nami. She has a reputation. She might not like it. It might be, even though she has every right to do so, but she was considerate of her feelings. Maybe she wouldn't like that. Her daughter-in-law was going out in the fields collecting. So she didn't, you see, she wasn't affected. Most people wouldn't stop and think. I mean, what are you talking about? I need. When a person's in a state of need, they act differently, and they think it gives them a license to other people's generosity, whatever the case. Well, what do you mean you're sensitive? I can't be concerned about your sensitivity. No. You see? Her perfection came through even in that situation where she wasn't obligated to get her mother-in-law's permission. That's what strikes me. She didn't need her mother-in-law's permission. She wasn't doing anything wrong. But she's considerate about her feelings. What if it hurts her emotionally? So I'll do something else. And she says, no, go, my daughter. So she went. But she also said something very interesting. She didn't have to... There was no need to find favor. She had a right. This is not tzedakah. This is her. She had a right to take it. Oh. And most people would be very happy in that situation. There's another emotion. There are, if we're honest, we have all kinds of emotions. You have emotions when you're in power, when you have wealth, and you also have emotions when you're out of it, and when you're needy, and you have access to somebody else's. There is a certain emotion you have to be a guardian. It's enjoyable to be able to take somebody else's property. What they call a schnara kind of emotion. But it's justifiable. I can go to anybody's field right now, and you've got to be on guard. She didn't want to be affected by that emotion. It's just this, objectively. You see, interestingly enough, and then there are people that refuse to take altogether. When the halacha demands that you should take. There's all kinds of emotions over here, and there's no one emotion that a person can follow. Because some people will say, I'm not taking, that's it. Even if the situation is one, there is a situation. God did ordain laws
And of course, we pray that everybody wants to have his dignity, and that's part of the benching. That we should God should provide us what we need. Below lowly day matnas blessed adam, we shouldn't have a need for the matanos of other people. Below the day halva asam, and we shouldn't even have a need for that. We're alone, and alone is something you pay back. But still, you're after somebody else's mercy. But nevertheless, a person has to recognize as part of reality there are God did ordain laws of charity, and the highest level of charity, of course, is to help a person before they fallen. But even so, there's a situation in life where things have come upon you, hard times have come upon you, and it would be the emotions, there's different emotions. There's certain emotions in people that they're thrilled that they have, now they have access, they don't have to work anymore, they can take somebody else's. That's an emotion. There's also an emotion in a person that refuses. That's it, I cannot, which could be irrational. Because that's just your own pride. You have to be rational. The situation demands that you, that right now you're in a state of ideas and you have to take. So you take. Later on, you'll be out of the situation. You'll give to them. You see, it's just like I mentioned many times that for some people, it's almost an impossibility to ever eat on Yom Kippur. Where the halacha demands, I know people like that. People that with the halacha, they're very sick. They must take certain medication, or they must even eat, and they absolutely refuse. They can't, and if they do so, then they're feeling miserable. And I said it on many times, I chased it, that a person who eats on Yom Kippur because Allah dictates that he should feel no differently than the person who fasted that day. Both were because your happiness at the end of the day shouldn't be just an emotion, I toughed it out. Your happiness is you fulfilled the will of God. Now for some people, emotionally it's much easier. You say fast on Yom Kippur because that has a very powerful emotional significance, right? It could require more perfection for the person who's obligated to eat. You say to eat on Yom Kippur when the halacha says you have to eat. Now, in her situation, she related to this most difficult area of halacha from perfection, purely from the rational standpoint. She wasn't overcome by any emotion. She didn't feel that this gave her a license to neglect the feelings of her mother-in-law. She took that into consideration, but also she would not burden herself upon someone who she recognized that maybe the other person wouldn't want me in the field. And even though I have a right, I'm armed with the right of the Torah to come in and take it, she wouldn't hurt his feelings. She would only go, you see? That's a very high level of perfection. I see myself. You see among people who are aniyim, because a lot of aniyim comes to the door all the time. All the time. No, but there are certain people who you could tell that it has affected them, and they have lost any sense of respect for your own privacy, for your own, or any sensitivity. It's just a certain attitude. And you don't even feel good. It's like a demanding kind of thing. They come whenever they want. And you just feel that you're being mistreated. And that's not the way it should be. Or if you give, they'll complain or whatever. You should give more, whatever, they make you feel. And it's not their affairs. And I think to myself that that's not right either. You have a right to ask for money and no one should demean you in any way, but that doesn't give you the right to disregard somebody else's feelings. You see, you know what I'm saying? That does exist. That doesn't mean that you don't give that person either, and you have to be very careful how you treat the person as an ani. I don't want to make the point that you should mistreat ani, and that's a terrible, terrible thing. I'm just saying that I observe from this that it does produce, there are people that come and they have their dignity, and they're very thankful and very respectful, and which the way it should be. And you don't even have to be thankful, but I do notice that some people already have lost that sense, a certain hostility or a certain insensitivity to the to the other person. And that can happen. That can happen to a person. And you see that the perfection of Naomi was that did not affect her in any way. That she retained her perfection even in this difficult situation. That's why, you see, that's what he noticed. That's what he noticed. He noticed her special qualities, that even in a situation which would tend to a person loses their self-esteem, they lose their sensitivity. And also, what's the big deal that she only took two and not three? This showed her tremendous perfection. Because when a person, there's two ways a person can relate to Gezel. Technically speaking, it's usher, but the truth is, a person can always find a heterium for this kind of thing. It's different. The owner really doesn't. You know, I'm busy. I'm collecting and this and that. The truth is, the owner probably wouldn't care if you took three instead of two. Who really cares? You see. So when a person, there's a certain type of Gezel. You see that most people wouldn't care about. Like you see, it says about Moshe that he, when he shepherded the sheep of his father-in-law, they're way off into the wilderness, so that it shouldn't be near anybody's property. Right? Now, what's the point? And that was the whole dispute, by the way, between the shepherds of Lot and Abraham over Gezel. You know, it was a theoretical kind of thing here. Where they graze their animals. The point is that there could be lands that nobody really uses, right? And you could say, well, what difference does it make if it doesn't belong to me, but the other person doesn't really care anyway. You see? Now, the other person is just on the level where he relates to stealing in an emotional kind of a way, because I'm harming the other person, that I won't do. But if it's abstract, a lot of people today think that, by the way. A lot of people have no compunction if it's the insurance company or it's a big corporation and they won't miss it. People take things from the office or whatever, which they really shouldn't, but they go, who cares? They've got millions that I'm going to know. And they don't. Well, in other words, but they would never think of taking somebody's briefcase or going into somebody's house and taking an object from there, what's going to hurt? And hurt somebody, they would never do. But on a certain level, if it's abstract and you really can't see anybody being hurt by it, so then that's the difference. A perfected person is justice. He's involved in the area because of his own perfection in terms of justice. Therefore, it makes no difference. You're following the halachic definition. This is a violation of the will of God. It doesn't make any difference whether you can relate to it on an emotional, personal level or not. That's what he saw in her. In that situation where she was so careful, you see, she was extra careful not to violate in a technical manner the prohibition, even if it should turn out that the average person, you could overlook it, you don't have to be that careful, and you saw it, that would indicate that she had a certain mentality. The second thing that he noticed was her tzniyus. Now, what was her modesty? What is significant about that? And both of them, you see, modesty is very important in Judaism. See, modesty really indicates two perfections. The immodest person, the one who's showy, who's flaunting, first of all, it means that they regard their sensual side, the physical side, as being the essence of their personality. That's what immodesty is about. In other words, you're flaunting your physical appearance. That shows that to you, the essence of your personality resides in your physical appearance. That's the first element in immodesty. That's why modesty is so important, because modesty is an expression of kedusha. You see the two elements. Manat feeling is justice. That's perfection in terms of justice. The other, the manner in which she bent down indicated. You see what a chacham balaz was. He could read. Which also, my other question was, but what do you mean, but you see, did see? Of course, because it's not a crazy for a mock kind of thing that you can't look. Yeah. It meant to say that he wouldn't be looking at the girls for curiosity, out of lewdness, that type of thing. You know, let's see who's out here today. No, but to observe behavior, you see, in terms of observing the behavior, to deduce certain principles, that type of looking is intelligent, is rational. It doesn't mean you have to be crazy about it, like just go around with blinders on your eyes. He observed behavior patterns. And he had the chachma to see what this indicated. The modesty indicates her perfection in the realm of Kedusha. That is to say that the truly perfected person is modest in terms of the recognition that the essential part of your personality is not the physical, not the external,
but the Tzelem Elokim. And secondarily, modesty indicates, see, the immodest person is wrong on two counts. Because first of all, they're identifying their essence as their physical part, that's one. And secondly, they're flaunting, which means to say that the true good is to be observed by others, what others think of you. The real idea of modesty is, you see, kol kvod bas melech penima. Well, you see, the penima means to say, it represents more than that. It's not just that it's indecent, it's not proper and all of that. It hits a very important philosophical point, that ultimately we relate to the good in a purely objective fashion, but not because of what people think of us, which is the biggest hurdle to overcome, because most people are living in the world of showing it, of what others think, of maintaining a certain reputation, a certain image for others. And modesty really indicates that it's penima, that we do the good for the sake of the good itself, and we're only concerned truthfully about what God thinks of us. That's all contained in the idea of modesty. And the point of it is that she exhibited these elements, and I'm saying that what makes it so special is that at a time when most people would tend to lose their sense of dignity. You see, when a person experiences poverty, they lose their dignity and then they don't really care anymore. But that didn't have the effect upon her. Okay, Yaakov's with the idea that she was really a descendant of the daughter of Eglon, so she was from royalty. This would only, I didn't even mention that, just on its own terms, but I think we should study it on its own terms, and not just in, because then you'll say, oh, for a princess it's one thing, but for the average person, you see. But it is true, given, of course, that she did come from royalty, this only makes it how much more so. Yeah. Then he gets special, then he speaks to her. And he tells her, he takes her under his wing. This becomes a very important thing. You know, he takes her under his special protection. Of course, later on he's going to be her true goel, the true redeemer. But at this point in time he begins to act with, you know, a special deference to her. He tells her, first of all, not to go to glean in any other field, not to leave, and to cling to my maidens. So he's giving her, this is a certain amount of acceptance, a certain amount of security. She doesn't have to go wandering from field to field. Of course, you wonder throughout all of this, he hasn't offered to take her off the doll, so to speak. He's not offered to do that. But he is going, she's going to still be gleaning. There's a reason for that. And he says, stick to the field that you've been, where they're reaping, and follow after them. And I have already told the, look how far he's gone, I've already told the youngsters not to bother you. And if you get thirsty, then you can drink from the water that they themselves will draw. Apparently, this wasn't, you know, the workers would draw their own water, and that was for them. And they'd get upset if a stranger would take their water, because they had to do the work of, you know, of drawing it. So don't hesitate to drink the water. Now, what's her reaction? So she falls on her face, and she bows down as a sign of respect to him, and she says to him, why have I found favor in your eyes, so that you recognize me, special treatment? I am a stranger. Now you see from here, again, the same idea. She asks, most people would be very thrilled, they take it for granted, that they'd be happy with this. But she doesn't understand why she's being treated any differently. She didn't feel that she was entitled to special treatment. Now Boaz answered and said to her, it's been told to me. So he knows all the whole story. Everything you did for your mother-in-law after the death of her husband. And you abandoned your father and your mother and the land of your birthplace. And you went to a nation that you did not know yesterday or the day before. May God reward you for your actions, and may your payment compensation be complete from God, the Lord of Israel. Now this is the crucial phrase, whom you have come to find shelter under his wings. Well, what does that mean? What's he saying? Here he's explaining why he acted specially. What was the basis of Boaz's, what's the point of it? He's treating her differently, apparently. He did not treat everybody this way. It's interesting. He treats her, she was a convert, better than he treated, I'm sure he treated everybody well. But what is the reason for this? See, I would say that he was motivated by two things. First of all, there's Akar Sato. Because on the one hand, he mentions two things. He has to recognize her chesed that she had done. As we said before, she had done a tremendous chesed with Naomi. After she had, she was alone. She was an almana, and it's not. She didn't have to, you know, take any special care of her, but she stuck together with her. So on the one hand, it's a recognition, it's a karas atov. But the second thing is because she converted. Because she converted to Judaism. And what does he mean by this when he says that this blessing that your reward shall be complete from God and you've come to find shelter under his wings? See, it's basically fulfilling this halacha over here. Because the Rambam in Hilchos Deos, he talks about the mitzvah of the Reach Kamoha, that you have to love your friend. Now, Reach over here means a fellow Jew, as yourself. Okay? That means that you have to just be concerned, just as you're concerned about your own property, about your own honor, so too you have to be concerned about his. Now, what about a ger? How does a ger fit into this picture? If somebody converts, do you have to operate in the same way to them in terms of the opera? Come on. Does anybody know? He says, interestingly enough, he says like this: Ahavas ager, the love of the ger. Yeah, but it's more than that. When a person fulfills the mitzvah of the aflerech kamocha with a ger, he says it's two mitzvahs, it's a separate mitzvah in the Torah. Ahavas ager shebo v'nichnas tachas kanfei hashchina. The same terminology. The love of the ger, the convert, who has come and taken shelter beneath the wings of the Shechina, so to speak. Shtei mitzvasei. He fulfills two positive commands. That's interesting. Achas b'nei shehu b'chlal reyin. One, because of the fact that he's in the category of reyin. He's a friend. In other words, there's no difference. There's no difference between someone who's born Jewish and someone who converts to Judaism in terms of being a reach, your friend. But there's a separate mitzvah over here. The achas b'nei shehu ger, and one because it's a ger. The Torah amra v'ahavtem es ager, and the Torah said you shall love the ger. Tziva alav es ager, God commanded us concerning the love of the ger, kemoshe tziva al avas atzmo, just like he commanded us to love himself, that we should love God. Shnei of the aftes Hashem lekecha. Hakadosh Baruch Hu atzmo ohed gerim. God Himself loves gerim. Shneimar vi ohed ger, as it says, and God, referring to God, the ohed ger, and He loves the ger. Now the question is like this stuff: what do you mean loves the ger? But the ger is not a ger, he's a Jew. How do you distinguish between the two? And how do you make it, how do you have two mitzvahs? One, ger just describes, it would seem to me, my problem with this is, ger just describes the manner in which the person became a Jew. So now he's a Jew, what do you mean a ger? In what sense is he a ger? In other words, you see from this that the ger, of course, is a Jew. So that's why, since he's a Jew, he fits into the category of Reach, or your friend, and you fulfill the mitzvah of loving your friend as yourself. But he's a separate component within the Jewish community. The Jewish community consists of two different groups, interestingly enough. There's a status. In other words, it's not like there's just status of Jew, non-Jew. There's a Jew who was born a Jew. He forms one element. Then there's the community of converts. They form an adjunct to the community of Jews. It's a separate community within the Jewish people.
is sort of an extension of the Jewish people. And they, you have to treat them in a special kind of a way because they represent a very unique idea. It's a, in many respects, I mean, who's on a higher level? In many respects, the one who converted, you see that this is what he's saying over here. This requires a tremendous level of perfection in that you abandon everything. This represents attachment to God in the highest way because you abandon all the natural sources of attachment, of support. You came to find refuge under the wings, under the sheltering wings of God. You put yourself in God's hands, basically. Now that's it. Even the Jew, you're born Jewish. So of course, the Jewish people is a minority, we're alone, but you still have a people. You have family, you have friends, you have a group, this is your group. But you're a total stranger. You're a complete stranger. And you don't have any group. You've given up all the natural sources of support. That's why the ger, the avas ager, is a separate mitzvah. Aside from the fact that he's a fellow Jew, but he represents an individual who has given up all of the natural sources of support because of his complete commitment to the concepts of Torah. And that's why it's a separate fulfillment. That's why God has a special relationship to that person. Because that person has given up everything and put all their trust in God, so God has a special protection, a special commitment. That, I believe, is what he's expressing in the second idea. With Rus. That he finds her deserving. Now he has to respond to that. You see? Because if God loves the ger, and our perfection is to emulate the ways of God, so he's taking special measures. He's doing things that perhaps he would not do. Perhaps he would not do for the average Jew. For the average Jew, he treats him decently, he comes to his field, he's being nice, fine, you don't do anything more than that. And the average Jew doesn't need any special protection.
He says, Yishalom HaDashem Pa'alech. You're worthy, what you did. And of course, see, let's be honest. Categorically, this applies to any ger. But we know that people convert, and they may have many, you know, this represents the ultimate, the perfect conversion. But people can convert for many different reasons. There's different levels of conversion. See, that's why, Lori, this fits in. He had seen firsthand from her behavior the level of perfection. So he recognized firsthand that her conversion was motivated by the highest principle. This is the ultimate convert. This is someone to whom this applies. You know, people can, practically speaking, conversion represents the idea of giving up everything. You see? But in a practical sense, it can be different. People can convert for many reasons. But she didn't. When she attached herself to Naomi, Naomi had nothing. She was a stranger. She had no money. She had lost her husband. She had no influence. So it was purely as an expression of attaching herself to the wings of the Shekhinah. That's why that's the greatness of Boaz. See, there's two greatnesses. Two great people are coming together over here. One person represents that level of commitment to the absolute. Okay. And how many people, we have people, it's another greatness, and that is to say when you see a person in your midst who does reflect these ideals, and who is a tznuah, so they're not flaunting it. By definition, the tznuah is not flaunting it. It takes a great person to notice, and he was able to notice. The greatness of Boaz is that he's able to notice the great qualities that she possesses, and he responds to it. And he fulfills the ways of God, that you came to find refuge under the wings of the Shekhinah, you will find refuge under it. I'll see to it that you'll find a refuge. You see? Because, and that's the true refuge, because God did set up a system in which people act in accordance with the Torah, will respond that way to the ger. You see? That's the reason for his special treatment of Rus. Okay, there's a separate mitzvah to love the ger. There's two mitzvahs. To treat, when you fulfill the mitzvah of Avos Hager, so too, negatively, to oppress, to afflict, is a separate issue of ger lo silchot. You're not allowed to afflict them, which means you're not allowed to bring up their past in any way, or even just another thing, because sometimes Jews are insensitive about that, to speak negatively about Gentiles in their presence. You're not allowed to you know, like, let's say there's a convert in the vicinity, or there's a conversation, and you just, you mention something about, somebody brings up about something, oh, he's a guy, or a dumb guy, you just say something derogatorily about a guy, you don't want to do that. Because even though they're not, even though they have converted, and they're Jewish, they don't identify, but they, on an emotional level, it bothers them. Because
they...
Person, there's nothing wrong with knowing. No, there's nothing wrong with knowing that a person, you should know that someone's a convert. What's wrong? First of all, there's two mitzvot. Yeah, it's a positive. The designation of ger is a positive thing. But you, I'm just trying to show you that you should not, you have to be very sensitive to their feelings. That you should not afflict them in any way. Because they're in a very, they are in a very vulnerable, they have placed themselves, that's the point. When a person has placed himself in an emotionally vulnerable situation, only because of his will of God, you have a, that creates a new achiev, a special achiev. That's the lesson that we can take from this. To apply it even not to a ger. It doesn't have to, see, once you have the abstract idea, it doesn't only apply to a ger. See, the universal principle is that if a person has put himself in a vulnerable situation because of an idealistic motive, because he wants to do a good thing for Torah, then you have to respond to that and to assist him and to help him and not to to hurt him in any way.
This, I believe, is probably the most difficult, not probably, definitely the most difficult part of the whole story of Rus, which until now is rather understandable. It goes pretty smoothly, you know, in terms of, all right, we, in Perek Rishon, the main theme is the idea of conversion. The conversion of Rus, we went into that. It presented with certain problems, how they took and married the women within Moabiot. But the next parak, this whole idea of what takes place next, the marriage, is extremely difficult to understand. But really there are two things that are difficult to understand. One is the idea of the marriage. And when we speak about the idea of the marriage, what is it about the marriage that's strange? Even the very marriage itself, the fact that, you know, we read about Boaz, and Boaz is a very unusual man, Gibor Chayil, a very high-level individual. That, in and of itself, the fact that Rus would wind up marrying Boaz, I mean, he was a man of great qualities, and he appreciated, and she was a woman of great qualities, and he was able to recognize it. That's why he singled her out for special treatment. So the fact that the two would eventually get married, that's not such, that's not what's difficult about it. What is difficult about the marriage is what? That it's referred to as a form of ge'ula. The idea of ge'ula comes into the picture. That's what makes it, it's a form of redemption. It has to do, it's a very complicated kind of marriage. And it's not as would seem. I mean, it seems on the one hand that part of the motivation of Naomi is to find to take care of Rus, to find her a husband. So the story moves. That's why the Torah doesn't operate in conformity with our expectations. You know, you just always have to be prepared to be thrown into a state of confusion. You can't make demands on Torah that it has to conform to your own expectations, because your expectations are based upon what you know, which is very limited. The Torah is based upon the infinite knowledge of God. So you're going to have run up against a wall. You're going to run up against a wall. Here's a case where you run up against a wall, in my opinion. Because it's very difficult. So we're going to try and work on that. The truth is, the fact of the matter is, I really had worked out most of the elements, you know, that I discussed with you. I'm not saying most of the elements of the book, obviously, because we don't have that idea that we're working everything out. Except for the idea, I had a tough time understanding that, and Rabbi Chaik gave a shiur, and I'm basing myself on his concept, but I intend to elucidate on it and expand on it, you know, which I, you know, normally do if I can. And but the in terms of the underlying idea, I'm basing myself on his concept. Okay. Of course, the other problem, the obvious problem in Perek Gimel. What's the obvious problem in Perek Gimel? You've gone through Perek Gimel. What is the obvious problem? No? Yeah. Yeah, like it seems the plan by which she conveyed to Boaz that she was First of all, it's not the derech of a woman to go after a man. That's a statement in the Gemara, by the way. Right? Ki yikach hashisha is based on the pasuk that it's not the derech. I don't know what the story is like in our side today, but everything's been turned upside down. But in a normal situation, it's the derech, it's the custom, so to speak, for the man to pursue the woman. He or she does the opposite. But even that, the fact, so you'll say this situation wasn't the ordinary situation, whatever the case may be, but the plan that they concocted for her to communicate with him seems to be outrageous. It seems to be completely against all of the accepted customs, if you want to use the term. And it doesn't seem to be at all necessary that she would... It involved a tremendous amount of risk, by the way, also. Where do you see that this plan, it wasn't just... It's not only difficult because it's unusual, and it seems to be lacking in the proper modesty. You know, it's very forward of her to do this, and it doesn't mean... I don't see what the point of the whole thing is. It's also very risky. What was the risk, according to Chazal? Yeah, Boaz, so Chazal said that Boaz was very concerned after he discovered that she was there, that she should leave early, that he was mispalel, that no chilul Hashem should come about through him. Even though he hadn't done anything wrong, he did not want to be the cause of a chilul Hashem, because it could be a chilul Hashem. Looks kind of strange. You know, she's a younger woman, she was a beautiful woman, and she was dressed to kill in her best, all perfumed, and she's sneaking out of there early in the morning. He had nothing to do with it in the first place. So it could have happened. That's why he wakes up early, you know, provides her with food to take back. But he was being misfollowed, or it shouldn't be noticed. Now, even if it weren't noticed, it shows you the level that he's operating on. It's not my fault. Most people that do have a concern about preventing chilul Hashem say, look, I did everything. As long as they feel that it wasn't my fault, they wouldn't be dismayed about the objective chilul Hashem per se. No, he didn't want in any way to be associated with it, even if it wasn't his fault. So therefore the plan clearly involved risks that Naomi, I'm sure, was aware of. You see, she gives her careful instructions to avoid the damage that could have been done. But of course, the question is, isn't there a better way? There's got to be a better way to arrange a shidduch, it would seem, right? The story of the marriage begins with the return of Ruth. Every detail is important over here. And you know that Boaz took a special interest in Ruth, and it was based, and she didn't understand why, and he explains that it was based upon his hakaras hatov to her, his recognition of her, and recognition of her hakaras hatov, and that the treatment that she, how she had treated her mother-in-law after the death. And he tells her that because she had done chesed, he mentions the chesed that she had done with the living and with the dead. That's a very important concept. The idea of chesed to the dead is a very important theme that runs through the entire book. And also the fact that she had converted to Yahudus, and she had abandoned her entire family and people to come under the protection. In other words, she was committed, absolutely committed to the truth, no matter where it would lead her. And she joined up with the Jewish people. Now she comes back, and she tells this is very important, she tells this to her mother-in-law. When she comes back to Naomi, Naomi sees that she has a tremendous amount of food there, and she asks her what happened, and she tells her what happened. And in Pasuk, this is in Perek Beis, Pasuk Chaf, Vatomer Naomi l'chalasa, and Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, Baruch Hu L'Ad Hashem. This is the transition. This is where the idea, I believe, the idea that Naomi had of a marriage between Ruth and Boaz originates over here. Baruch Hu L'Ad Hashem, blessed is he of God. See, it's one thing to be blessed, but blessed of God. Most people, you know, are happy if they're blessed, and they're concerned about their reputation among people. But to be blessed of God, that's where you really forget about what people think of you, that in the eyes of God you're blessed. That's the real, because other people you can always fool. You know, you can always maintain a good reputation. Nobody knows what's going inside, so people go by the external. But to be blessed of God, that's she saw from his activities, from his behavior, his true perfection. But Asher lo ozav chasto es achayim, he didn't abandon his chesed for the living. And the es amazing. That's very important. Because the idea of the marriage has to do with chesed to the, not just to the chayim, it entails chesed to the living, but chesed to the mason. This is a very important link. Because if Nomi didn't know about this, that he still retained the idea that the deceased was deserving of this special chesed. That is, the deceased being Elimelech, Machlon, and Kilion, then I don't think, what? She told her. She told her, if you read the story, she, what happened? She told over the entire events, and also the discussion with, with Boaz. And that Boaz saw, as a result of what had transpired, Boaz saw fit to treat her, you know, so specially, and everything, you know, he had done for her. So he saw that Boaz still regarded, you see, regarded them as being worthy of chesed. That he showed a special chesed to Rus, because what Rus had done to, how she had acted towards Naomi. But Naomi had left Eretz Yisrael, so Naomi is associated with that entire group. So it's clear that Boaz was acting in terms of his obligation of chesed to Ruth herself. That's one thing, but it's more than that. It's also because of the chesed that she had shown, that Ruth had shown to the dead, to the deceased. Oh, so that's, so to Boaz that was important, you see. So Boaz was continuing that chesed. He was seeing to it, because he sent back food, a tremendous amount of food, so that Naomi should have everything that she needed as well. So he was concerned about Naomi. Why is he concerned about Naomi? That shows that he's concerned about the entire Mishpacha. The entire Mishpacha was still significant in his mind. So that's very important. Okay. Then, Vatomer la Naomi, and Naomi said to Korav la Nehoyesh, this man is a relative of ours. Migoalenu, he is among of our redeemers. Now that's very important. Because who cares about Goalenu? Goalenu means he's a relative in terms of, there are a number of different instances of Geula. For example, the classical case in the Torah is Steachuza. That's in Vayikra. It's in Vayikra Parshas Bahar. Perik Chafei, Pasuk Chafei. Chafei. It talks about the idea of Steachuza, an inherited field from your allotment in Eretz Yisrael if you become poor, impoverished. And you have to sell it. So there's an obligation upon the relatives of the person, to redeem the field. The halacha is that it can be redeemed after 2 years. On Yovel it goes back, it automatically reverts to the original owner. But the Yovel could be a long way off. In the meantime, he's without his field. And that's considered to be a big come down in the world, to have to sell a portion of his inheritance, of his field. So the Torah refers to this as being geula. That is to say that a relative steps forward after 2 years and he pays off the amount. They have a way of, you know, cheshbonning it out, so that the one who bought the field doesn't lose, he gets paid back. But it's an automatic, in other words, he can't refuse the sale. You have a right, an automatic right to redeem the field and to replay it, to return it to the to your brother. Okay, that's one instance of Geula. We're going to discuss that idea of Geula. So he is Migalim. Okay, the question of course is, what does that have to do with anything? Alright. Now the rest of this parak, she just tells Rus to listen, you know, to follow his advice, not to go into any other field, and because perhaps Rus might not have felt comfortable, might have felt, why should she only go in his field, maybe go somewhere else. But she says, no, you should go to his field and only stay there. Yeah. The concept over here is like this. There's a pasuk in Bahar. It's a perkafei lamedei. The whole idea over there is the obligation you have. The obligation you have to support your kin, your relative, your brother. Of course, everybody, every fellow Jew is your brother. But the obligation falls first of all. The closer the person is to you, the greater the obligation. That's how human nature operates. You see. That's what Chazal said. That's a pasuk, I think, in Yeshaya, if I'm not mistaken. Ulebsarcha altas alein. You're not allowed to hide yourself, so to speak, from your flesh, to be indifferent to the fate of your close relatives. Now here it says the chiyomach achicha, if your brother becomes poor. Umata yodo imach, and his hand is faltering. In other words, it happens from time to time. People fall upon hard times. I mean, even people that basically are successful in life, whatever, people, experience, the most successful people, if you sit down and listen to the life, they'll tell you it wasn't always this way. It was tough. Setbacks occur. There's no person that goes straight to the top. That's the way life is. And the point of it is that when a person does experience a setback, he now becomes vulnerable and in need of the assistance of others. And that assistance given at that proper time is the greatest chesed. Because that can mean the difference between restoring him to life or death. And then each person should recognize that he does need this, and he could not be who he is and what he is without the assistance of others, which was given without strings attached. And of course, family is extremely important. The whole unit, it's amazing how people, I kept mentioning it a lot this summer about this Hakaras HaTov, even to why it's not a popular thing to talk about, to one's parents. Because people always complain. People always complain about their parents, yet the obvious thing, as I said, like all my faults due to the way my parents, especially a little psychology, so they made this mistake, they made every mistake possible. Of course, if they compliment you, you never say, well, that's because my parents did, X, Y. You never, that's you. That's in spite of the fact that they did. In spite of that, you're so great that they did not destroy you completely. So it works in a very interesting, but the truth of the matter is, Hakar Zatov demands that we recognize the realities that we would not have anything were it not for the, of course, that's ultimately, by someone who's kafri tov can't have a proper relationship with God. Because he takes himself as being the center. He takes everything for granted. But the whole world should revolve around him. That's the fallacy. He doesn't recognize where he stands in the scheme of things. Hakar Zatov means to recognize where you stand. It's a humbling thing. Where you stand in the scheme of things. That basically, you have no inherent right to exist. You exist only because of the will of God. And within that, God established a whole framework. And whatever the benefits that you have is because of that whole framework. You wouldn't have existence were it not for others, and even that's mere existence. And then the fact that you were able to get an education and so on and so forth is because there's civilization, there's a society. I said even in terms of society today, people have that same attitude. It's okay. I mean, one can criticize corruption in society and try to improve it, but then there are people who have this negative thing that just blow up the whole thing, like this McVeigh. And I'm sure he has very, he can make it, maybe he's a mishugan, or he can make it, there are legitimate grievances. Yeah, but then you see where a person's operating with a very, defective character. It's like the person wants to take all the benefits of the society and doesn't recognize what he's doing is destroying that same society. So a lot of children act that way too. They want to leave, this pampered children, they're living at home, that he, they're living off the fat of the land, they want all the benefits. Unfortunately, the parents sometimes are too misguided to see the point, and they can't be firm. But they want to have all the benefits, and at the same time, not feel that they have any responsibilities, not have no obligation. Of course you have to do it for me. There's a certain attitude, and I think you all know what I'm talking about. No, but it applies to everybody. I don't mean to, to be the big shot, that I'm, because we all have these emotions, and it comes out in one way or another. So there's a very subtle theme of Hakar HaTov. Now, if your brother becomes poor, umata yado imach, it means, mata yado means he's beginning to falter. He hasn't fallen down yet. It's an interesting expression. Vechazakta bo. So you have to strengthen him. And the very important, that is to say, take a look at Rashi over there. Vechazakta bo. Al tani cheu sheyero v'yipol. Don't let him fall down. That's the very most people, you see. That's the real chesed. Most people will respond when a person is in the street and he doesn't have a place and he's starving, etc. Then their emotions bother them, so they'll do something. Yeah, but you could have to sit back and just look at the way the person is going in life, and you see he's having, and he's too ashamed to ask for help and all that. That's the time to step in. You see, before he has to have the degradation, when he can, when the situation can still be saved. That's the time to step in. And most people, that's a different level of chesed. That's a higher level. The Torah here teaches a higher level of chesed. Raj is the kosher lakima. It's going to be very hard to restore. Once a person's fallen, it's very hard to put him back together again. That's why it says you should start to strengthen from the time when he's beginning to slip. That's when, that's because if you, that's when it's easy to put him back on the right course. He says lamaze doma lamaze shalchamor. He gives a very interesting parable. He says it's similar to the case where an animal has a big load on it and starting to fall, you know. Odeh v'lachamor, while it's still on the animal, on the donkey, echad tofes bo omamido, one person can arrange it. You don't need a whole group of people. Nafal aretz, if it fell on the ground, chamisha ein mamidin oso. Then five people can't put it back on top of it. So it's a very, you know, right, very accurate analogy. That's the basic concept over here. So I can't go into all the particulars. Obviously, if the person has sold the field because he's not interested in taking care of it, he doesn't have the means, he doesn't want to, so you have to use your seichel. It doesn't mean that you always put him back in and he'll destroy the crops again. It doesn't make sense. The assumption is that he's fallen on hard times and you're going to help him out now with the assistance that's needed, right? Yeah, but without the field, he can't move forward. That's his basic sustenance. That would be the situation. Marriage, it seems to me, is constructed upon two pillars. One pillar is the concept of geula, of the steachuza, of the field, restoring the field to its owner. The second one, of course, is the pillar of the din of the institution of what? Of yibum. That's the other pillar. This marriage, even though, bear in mind that it's not a real yibum, okay? Okay, it's not a real yibum, but it's based upon, it's modeled after the concept. Here's it. Obviously, it's the philosophical equivalent of what the halachic yibum would be. Okay, let's take up the next. Let's go through the story. Okay, if you have your Megillas in front of you. Perikimel. Vatomala Nami. So Nami says to her, daughter-in-law, Biti, my daughter, I will seek for you, I must seek for you, a security that will be good for you. Okay, so that makes sense. She's referring over here to a husband. So she's going to help her get a husband. And now she proposes the idea to her. Boaz, our relative, with who you've been with his youths, his maidens, excuse me, with the maidens. Because that's why, you know, she had told her that she should go there and glean over there. Now behold, he's winnowing in the threshing floor, the barley. Okay, so this was after the season. She stayed with them till the end of the reaping season, and then they go into the threshing and the winnowing and so forth. So that was a big event, apparently. So she says, now she's telling me what to do to get all, you know, dolled up for the occasion. And wash and put on your perfume and get dressed up. And, you know, anoint yourself, don your best clothing, and go down to the threshing floor. Not exactly a romantic place, the threshing floor, but look. Okay, now don't be careful, and don't make yourself known. Don't let him know that you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. And then take careful note when he goes to sleep. And make sure you know the place where he's at. And you shall go. And here, the Elisa's Margalosov is, it's not exactly clear if it means to lie by his feet or to uncover. Elisa literally would mean to uncover his feet. And to lie down there, to sleep next to him. In other words, whatever it is, to sleep in a way that he would notice that there's somebody there. That's the point of it. But not until you're actually there. It's very strange. And he'll tell you what you shall do. What he's going to do. And she says, she'll do everything that you tell me I'm going to do. So she went down to the threshing floor. And she did everything that she was supposed to do. Okay? Okay, so I mean, all the logistics that doesn't concern us at this point, how she was able to get in without being seen. It could be that see, she was well known already. She was well known, so the sight of her being there would not be cause for, any special attention. And she was subtle. I guess she was subtle, whatever. She was able to pull it off. Now what happened? So Boaz ate, and Vayitav Libo, he was in a good frame of mind. He ate and he drank. Rashi says that he learned Torah. Interesting, because they do draw a comparison between his response, because it says in the Megillah that Achashverosh ate and he drank and his heart was merry, and that led. In other words, even if we say that it meant that his heart was merry because he had something to drink, he had some wine, he was in a good frame of mind. It was the end of the threshing season. Apparently, it had been famine, years of famine. Now it was years of plenty. It was a good time. A person is in a good frame of mind. But the contrast, that Achashverosh, when he was in that frame of mind, so all of his base instincts came out, and he demanded that Vashti should come. And of course, Chazal said that she should appear naked, whatever. It was just an opportunity to bring out his base instincts. But here, he had eaten, he had drinking, he was in a very good frame of mind, and then this beautiful woman is next to him, and he conquered his yetzer. He acted in a completely different manner. Then it says he went down to sleep, he chose his place to sleep at the edge of the heap, and then she came silently, stealthily, and she uncovered his feet, and she lied down. Okay. And then it was the middle of the night. So apparently he slept for a while. I guess, when he first went to sleep, he had just eaten and drank, and he fell into a deep sleep. But I guess towards midnight already, he wasn't in such a deep sleep. So it was in the middle of the night, and suddenly he was startled, and he shook up. Scared, all of a sudden there's somebody there. Behold, there was a woman who was sleeping by his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I am Rus, your servant. And will you," actually it's a statement, but it's in the form of a question, "spread your wings on your servant." That's a protection. To spread, that's an expression, by the way, of chuppah. The chuppah in certain communities, they have the a talus. They put a talus over the chassid and kallah. That's chuppah. It's an expression of the idea of marriage. He goel ata, because now she brings in the idea that there's two concepts over here. There's marriage and there's geula, there's redemption. And he says, "Blessed are you to God, my daughter." And this is a very strange expression. I'm going to try and understand this. Heitafta chastecha achrom min arishon. Your latter chesed is greater than your first chesed. Now, what is he talking about over here? Now, some say that it's a reference to the chesed that she did with Nami, and some say it's a reference to the fact that she converted. Actually, both ideas. I don't see why you have to say one or the other. Your first chesed was—that's what he had. We always refer to her. Praya chesed, when he first encountered her, the chesed that she displayed towards her mother-in-law after the death of her husband, that she took care of her and stayed with her. But that chesed also entailed the fact, and it's all one idea basically, because the two are hand in hand. Because what was the reason behind that chesed? The reason behind the chesed wasn't just an emotion; it was because of the qualities that she saw, which led her to cling to her, and she and part of that clinging was to embrace the whole Jewish people. So that's also referred to as chesed. That's what I'd like to explain. Somebody asked me at the beginning why the idea of becoming Jewish here is referred to as a chesed. And this chesed is greater than that chesed. Levilti leches acher abikur abachurim, the fact that you're not going after the young guys, imdal v'yamashiach, whether they be poor or wealthy. That's like a cryptic kind of a statement. He's praising her. This chesed that you're doing now, this marriage proposal, alright, is chesed. It's chesed. I don't know why it's chesed. She needs a husband.
It's a chesed of her former husband.
Yeah, well, we have to understand that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's greater than your first chesed, right? It's greater. Of course, the first chesed was also to the deceased. The first chesed, in other words, that was also a chesed to the deceased, in that she didn't abandon the mother of her husband. That was chesed to the husband as well.
But this is more subtle. The other one is like more practical, that you're not abandoning your mother-in-law. This is like a more subtle thing,
yeah,
that you're carrying on his name
Okay. Levilti, the fact that you didn't go after the bachurim, the young guys, because he was an old man, Boaz. Boaz was about 80 years old. Whether they be rich or poor, meaning to say that even though he's a wealthy guy, he was wealthy. Yeah, but naturally a woman doesn't want, I'm not talking about today's society, but naturally a woman doesn't want an older man, even if she'd rather have a younger man, all things being equal, even if he's poor, as opposed to an older man, even if he's wealthy. Of course, things have changed today. But it's really the same. The Ata Biti Altiri. He says, now don't be afraid. Everything that you've said, I'll do for you. For everybody knows that you are a very anacious chayel, a woman of valor, an unusual kind of a person. But then he says, he had something else. He says, now, if I am a goel, you see, because she's introduced the idea of a goel, of a redeemer. And the ganyesh goel karov imeni. Then I have to follow, if that's the case, then I have to follow according to the order. There's another goel who's closer than I am. Okay? And that means to say that he was the nephew. There were three brothers. Elimelech had two other brothers. Salmon, and then the third one could be his name. It's not clear whether he's the one who's referred to as Ploni Almoni. But some say he was referred to as Tov, because of the wording. He says, Lini Alayla, sleep here for the night. Alright? And in the morning, if he will, in Yigalech Tov, you go. Now, you can read that two ways. If his name is Tov, then it means if Tov will redeem you, then fine. Or you could say, if he will redeem you, right, then it's good. It'll be good. It's not clear whether the person's name was Tov or not. I don't say, for our purposes, it's not important. But if he doesn't desire to redeem you, then I'll redeem you. And he's taking an oath, Chai Hashem. That's the language of an oath. And he says to sleep here until the morning. So she slept by his feet until the morning, and then she got up. B'terem yakir ishes reyehu. Before, very early, before you could see, in other words, while it was still dark. And he said, don't let it be known that a woman has come here, because it could be a chel Hashem. Yeah, I'm quoting to you from the Midrash here. The Midrash says, all that night Boaz lay stretched out upon his face and prayed, Lord of the universe, it is revealed and known to you that I did not touch her. So may it be your will that it not be known that the woman came into the threshing floor, that the name of heaven be not profaned to me. It's a very high level, because he hadn't done anything wrong, so look, but he was meeting the spell that he should not in any way be associated with the Chel Hashem. It's a good question. I don't think it would make sense to leave. You know, you have to be a certain amount of practical judgment over here. It was dangerous. In fact, the Rashi mentions that the reason why was he there, sleeping at the at that place, you know, where they're doing the threshing, winnowing, and so forth, is that it was the days of the Shoftim, right? And there it was a dangerous time. There were lawless people, there were thieves and so forth, and he had to be down there to protect his own property himself. So it would be dangerous. You wouldn't send a woman home in the middle of the night. So therefore, he had to use his seichel. And seichel dictated that she sleep here, don't go now, but we'll get up very early. And he gives her a supply of food to bring back. He tells her to bring her a shawl and so forth. And he measures out a large measure of food, and she comes back to the city. Okay? Then she speaks to her Nami. Nami gives a report to Nami. And Nami tells her to just take it easy, to relax, until you find out what takes place, because the man will not rest. He's going to take care of this immediately. Okay. Now, in Perek Daled, what happens next? So Boaz goes up to the gate, and he stays there, and behold, the Goel. He knows where the Goel... I'm sorry? Yes, but bear in mind that this is philosophical. Halachically, there's no real obligation over here.
Of what?
To do anything. In terms of the geula of the field, he's closer. That's a good point. There were two things over here. Yeah. Ploni Almoni was closer in terms of, and you see that he accepts that. He accepts that responsibility to redeem the field. But then, when Boaz tells him about the other condition, that it entails the marriage, then he rejects it. And then Boaz has to go for it. Okay, let's just finish up and we'll discuss that. Yeah. But Boaz wanted to do it, that's clear. But you see, again, even a lot of times a person wants to do a certain mitzvah because it appeals to them. Like, we learned that the Vilna Gaon says it can appeal to you. He wanted to do this mitzvah, but even so, he didn't want to upset the halachic system. There's a certain order of priorities, and he doesn't come first. It's amazing that even for him, that would have been a sacrifice, giving up the opportunity to do a mitzvah. That's the level he was on. I know, but he wanted to do it. He wanted to do it. No, so you, when you want to do something, usually you can find ways of, right, of going about doing it. Now, so then he tells the individual to sit there. And he sat there. And he took 10 men from the Ziknei Eir. And so Chazal learned now from here that you need 10 people for Sheva Brachos. The point of these 10 was because there's going to be a wedding. Either him or Ploni Almoni. And now he's like this. He says to the Goel that the part of the field that is to our brother Elimelech. Elimelech is his uncle, but he refers to him as brother. He means a close kin. Machva Nami. Nami, see here, the Mepharshim learned, it's not that technical. It means over here that she's in the process. You see, you can't get too halachic over here, Lord. That's the point. You see, you have to bear in mind, understand, that the book is trying to communicate ideas of perfection. So when it's not interested in the technicalities of the halacha, but all the halachas reflect certain ideals. You see? This entire marriage is not a true yibum, halachically, because first of all, yibum is only the brother. That's the first thing. But there's a more profound reason why it can't be a true yibum. Yeah, the way we're learning, she wasn't Jewish. She was not Jewish in the first place. Now the obligation, so therefore there was no marriage in the first place. So therefore it's the whole thing, all the terminology over here does not make sense in a strict halachic sense. She's not really the mother-in-law, and she's not the wife. Nothing happened. But it's reflecting, everything over here is reflecting the philosophical concepts. The same is true with the geula of the field. Because the Mepharshim point out that it's not, machra doesn't mean she sold it already. Machra has to be understood as she's going to have to sell it. It's like she sold it because she's very poor. She's impoverished and she's going to have to sell it. Now the reason why they say is because if you sold it, then you'd have to wait 2 years. As I told you, you cannot redeem it until 2 years. So therefore, the term machra is translated as she's in the process of. So you'll perform the task of being a girl by marrying her, exactly. Hashava Mizdei Moav. Now, Vani Amarti Egla Oznecha Lemor. And I have said, I have determined, I have resolved to make you aware of this, that you should purchase the field in the presence of those that are sitting here, and in the presence of the Zakenim. And if you desire to redeem, fine. And if not, if you don't want to redeem, then tell me, and I will know that there's no one besides you to redeem, and I come after you. I'm the next in line. But Yomer, he said, Anochi Yada, I'll do it. So he liked the idea. He liked the idea of redeeming the field. But he didn't know that there was another component in the plan. And Boaz said, on the day that you purchased the field from Naomi and from Rus, Hamoavia, Eisha Sameis, Karnisa, now he reveals the plan to him. On the day that you purchase the field from Nani and from Rus, Eishes Ameis Karnisa, you'll have purchased it. Lahakim Shem Ameis Al Nachalasa. In order to perpetuate the name of the deceased on his inheritance. Now you're talking about Machalah. Now he reveals the true idea. In other words, when he first broached the idea, he didn't know what he was getting at. He thought it was just a practical thing to retain the field in the family. And that's the basic concept of being a Goel. So she shouldn't have to sell it. So he'd hold on to the field for them. But then he said, one second, there's another idea over here. And that is to say that you're going to marry the wife of Machalon, and therefore to restore the name, to perpetuate the name. Lahakim Shem Ameis Al Nachalasa. That's the expression by which we find by Yibum. And then the Goel said, Lo Uchal Ligo. Then he said, I can't do this. I can't. If that's what you're talking about, I can't do it. Lest I destroy my own inheritance. He says, You shall redeem it, for I can't do the redemption. Now this Chazal say there are two reasons. They give two reasons why he refused. One was because Ashkes, he'll destroy his own family life. In other words, he maintained that he couldn't do it because it would destroy, you know, his wife, his relationship with his own family. And others say that it's because of the idea of Moavia. Because that itself, that idea that you know, there's an Isser of a Moab, you can't marry a person from Moab, because they're third generation. They can't come into the congregation. Because they didn't greet you with bread and water when you were in the desert. But the halacha was unknown at the time, had been forgotten, so to speak. The halacha was the halacha of Moshe Gina. This only applies to Moavi, below Moaviyah. Okay? Really, a Rus, you were permitted to marry. Once she converted, she was permitted to marry. But that idea that the issue to enter into the Kahal only applies to a Moavia, not a Moavia, was controversial at the time. So Boaz convened the Bezdin, and they didn't decide the halacha then. The halacha was known, but they made it clear. But according to some, he was reluctant to marry her because of the fact that she was a Moavia. It was sort of like a taint, that type of thing. Yeah. Halacha of Moab is a very interesting point in its own right. The exclusion of Moavim is because of the absence of Chesed. That's one of the hallmarks of a Jew. Right? Rachmanim, Baishanim, Vagom.